Petra stopped going along on the interviews with Valescu. They could hardly be called interrogations. Direct questions led nowhere. Threats seemed to mean nothing. It was maddening and stressful, and she hated the way he looked at her. Looked at her belly, which was showing her pregnancy more and more every day. But she still kept on top of what they were calling, for lack of a better name, the Valescu Project. The head of electronic security, Ferreira, was working most intensely on trying to track down everything Valescu had been doing with his computer and tracking his various identities through the nets. But Petra made sure that the database searches and indexes that they already had underway continued. These babies were out there somewhere, implanted in surrogate mothers, and at some point, they were going to give birth. Valescu wouldn't risk their lives by forbidding the mothers access to good medical care. In fact, that was bound to be a minimum. So they would be born in hospitals, their births registered. How would they find these babies in the millions that would be born in that time frame? Petra couldn't begin to guess. But they'd collect the data and index it on every conceivably useful variable, so it was there to work with when they finally figured out some identifying marker.
Meanwhile, Bean conducted the interviews with Valescu. They were yielding some information that proved accurate, but it was hard for Bean to decide whether Valescu was unconsciously letting useful information slip or deliberately toying with them by bleeding out little bits of information that he knew would not be terribly useful in the end.
When he wasn't with Valescu, Bean was with Anton, who had come away from retirement and accepted a heavy level of drugs to control his aversive reaction to working in his field of science. "I tell myself every day," he said to Bean, "that I'm not doing science. I'm merely grading a student's assignments. It helps, but I still throw up. This is not good for me."
"Don't push any harder than you can."
"My wife helps me," said Anton. "She's very patient with this old man. And you know what? She's pregnant, in the natural way."
"Congratulations," Bean said, knowing how hard this was for Anton, whose sexual desires did not tend in the same direction as his reproductive plans.
"My body knows how, even at this old age," he laughed, "doing what comes unnaturally."
But his personal happiness aside, the picture Anton began to paint looked worse and worse.
"His plan was simple enough," said Anton. "He planned to destroy the human race."
"Why? That makes no sense. Vengeance?"
"No, no. Destroy and replace. The virus he chose would go straight to the reproductive cells in the body. Every sperm, every ovum. They infest, but they don't kill. They just snip and replace. All kinds of changes. Strength and speed of an East African. A few changes I don't understand because nobody's really mapped that part of the genome. Not for function. And some I don't even know where they fit on the human genome. I'd have to try them out, and I can't do that. That would be real science. Someone else. Later."
"You're sidestepping the big change," said Bean.
"My little key," said Anton. "His virus turns the key."
"So he has no cure, no way to switch the key for intellectual ability without also triggering this perpetual growth pattern."
"If he had it, he'd use it. There's no advantage not to."
"So it is a biological weapon."
"Weapon? Something that affects only your children? Makes them die of giantism before they're 20? Oh, that would make armies run in panic."
"What then?"
"Valescu thinks he's God. Or at least he's playing dress-up with God's clothing. He's trying to jump the whole human race to the next stage of evolution, spread this disease so that no normal children can be born ever again."
"But that's insane. Everybody dying so young?"
"No, no, Julian, no. not insane. Why do humans live so long? Mathematicians and poets, they burn out in their mid-twenties anyway. We live so long because of grandchildren. In a difficult world, grandparents can help ensure the survival of their grandchildren. The societies that kept their old people around and listened to them and respected them, that fed them, always do better. But that's a community on the edge of starvation, always at risk. Are we at risk so much today? If these wars keep getting worse. Yes, war, said Anton. Kill off a whole generation of men, yet the grandfathers keep their sexual potency. They can propagate the next generation even if the young ones are dead. But Volescu thinks we're ready to move beyond planning for the deaths of young men. So he doesn't mind having generations that are less than 20 years? Change society's patterns. When were you ready to assume an adult role, Bean? When was your brain ready to go to work and change the world?
Age 10. Earlier, if I'd had a good education.
So, you get a good education. All our schools change because children are ready to learn at age 3, age 2. By age 10, Volescu's gene change takes place. The new generation is completely ready to take over for the old, marry as early as possible, breed like bunnies, become giants. Irresistible in war, unless they keel over from heart attacks. Don't you see? Instead of spending the young man in violent death, we send the old men, the 18-year-olds. While all the work in science, technology, building, planting, everything, all done by the young men, the 10-year-olds, all of them like you, not human anymore, a different species, yes? The children of Homo sapiens, Homo lumens, maybe, still capable of interbreeding, but the old style of human, they grow to be old. But they are never big, and they are never very smart. How can they compete? They are gone, Bean. Your people rule the world.
They wouldn't be my people.
It's good that you're loyal to old humans like me. But you are something new, Bean. And if you have any children with my little key turned, no, they won't be fast like what Volescu has designed. But they'll be brilliant, something new in the world. When they can talk to each other instead of being alone like you, will you be able to keep up with them? Well, maybe yes, for you, but will I be able to keep up with them? Bean laughed bitterly.
Will Petra? That's what you're saying.
You had no parents to be humiliated when they found out that you were learning faster than they can teach. Petra will love them just as much. Yes, she will. But all her love won't turn them human.
And here you told me that I'm definitely human. Not true after all.
Human in your loves, your hungers, in what makes you good and not evil, but in the speed of your life, the intellectual heights, are you not alone in this world?
Unless that virus is released.
How do you know it won't still be released? Asked Anton. How do you know he hasn't already completed a batch and disseminated it? How do you know he didn't infect himself and now he spreads it wherever he goes? In these past weeks since he got here, how many people in the hegemony compound have had a cold, sniffly nose, itchy penis, tender nipples? Yes, he used that virus as his base. He has a sense of humor, an ugly kind.
I haven't checked on the subtler symptoms, but we've had the normal number of colds.
Probably not, said Anton. He probably didn't make himself a carrier. What would be the point? He wants other people to spread it.
You're saying that it's already out there.
Or he has website that he has to check every week or every month. And then, 1 month, he doesn't do it. So a signal is sent out to some of Ashil's old network. The virus gets broken out and used, and all Valescu had to do to trigger it was be a captive with no access to computers. Was his research that complete? Could he have a working virus? I don't know. All his records were changed when he moved. When you sent him a message, you told me about that, yes? You sent him a message and he moved to Rwanda. Before that, maybe he had an earlier version of the virus. Maybe not. Maybe this is the first time he put the changed human genes into the virus. If that's the case, then no, it has not been released. But it could be. It's ready. Ready enough. Maybe you caught him just in time. And if it is out there, what? Then I hope the baby my wife is pregnant with, I hope it's one like you, and not one like me. Why? Your tragedy, Bean, is that you are the only one. If all the world will soon be like you, then you know what that makes you. A damn fool. It makes you Adam. Anton was unbearably complacent about this. What Bean was, what was happening to him, he wouldn't wish on anyone. Not his child and not Anton's. But Anton could be forgiven for his idiotic wish. He had not been so small. He had not been this large. He could not know how larval the early stage was. Like silkworms, the larva of my species does all the work of its life while it's young. Then the big butterfly. That's what people see. But all it has left to do in its life is get laid, then lay eggs, then die. Bean talked it through with Petra, and then they went to Ferreira and Peter. Now the computer search was geared, with some urgency, toward detecting any kind of dead man switch that Valescu was signing on to every day or every week. No doubt the dead man switch was set to destroy itself as soon as its message was sent, which meant that if it was already sent, it wouldn't be there anymore. But somewhere there were tracks, backups, records of one kind or another. Nobody traveled the networks clean. Not even Bean. He had made himself untraceable by constantly changing everything. But Valescu had stayed rooted in a lab here or a lab there as long as he could. He might not have been as careful in his maneuvers through the nets. After all, Valescu might think he was brilliant, but he was no Bean.
Chapter 7. An Offer. From Peter Wiggin, private at hegemon.gov, to Vlad, impaled at gcu.ru.gov. Ray, my brother's friends. I'd like to have a chance to talk with you, face to face, for my brother's sake, on neutral territory.
Peter arrived in St. Petersburg ostensibly to be an observer and consultant at the Warsaw Pact trade talks that were part of Russia's ongoing effort to set up an economic union to rival the Western European one. And he did attend several meetings and kept his suite humming with conversations. Of course, his agenda was quite different from the official one, and he made good headway with, as expected, representatives from some of the smaller or less prosperous countries, Latvia, Estonia, Slovakia, Bulgaria, Bosnia, Albania, Croatia, Georgia. Every piece in the puzzle counted. Not every piece was a country. Sometimes it was an individual. That's why Peter found himself walking in a park, not one of the magnificent parks in the heart of St. Petersburg, but a smallish park in Kotlajärve, a town in northeastern Estonia with the delusions of cityhood. Peter wasn't sure why Vlad had chosen a town that involved crossing borders. Nothing could have made their encounter more obvious. And being in Estonia meant there'd be two intelligence services watching them, Estonia's and Russia's. Russia hadn't forgotten history. They still watched over Estonia using their domestic spy service rather than the foreign one. This park was, perhaps, the reason. There was a lake, no, a pond, a skating pond in winter, Peter was sure, since it was almost perfectly round and over-equipped with benches. Now, in the summer, it was undoubtedly advertised with a suck-blood-and-lay-eggs-all-in-one-place campaign among the mosquitoes, which had shown up in profusion.
"Close your eyes," said Vlad.
Peter expected some kind of spy ritual and, sighing, complied. His sigh left his mouth open, however, just enough to get a good taste of the insect repellent that Vlad sprayed in his face.
"Hans," said Vlad, "tastes bad, but doesn't kill. Hans."
Peter held out his hands. They were sprayed, too.
"Don't want you to lose more than a pint during our conversation. Horrible place. Nobody comes here in summer, so it isn't pre-wired. Lots of clear meadows. We can see if anybody's watching us."
"Are you that closely watched?"
"Russian government not as understanding as hegemon. Sir Yawong stays in your confidence because you believe he always opposed a shield, but me, not trusted. So, if you think I have influence..." "Very wrong thinking, my friend. Not why I'm here." "Yes, I know you're here for trade talks," Vlad grinned.
"Not much point to trade talks when smuggling and bribery make any kind of custom collection a joke anyway," said Peter.
"I'm glad you understand our way of doing things," said Vlad. "Trust no one that you haven't bribed within the last half hour."
"Don't tell me that you really have that thick a Russian accent, by the way," said Peter. "You grew up on battle school. You should speak common, like a native."
"I do," said Vlad, still in a thick Russian accent, "except when my future depends on giving people no reason to remember how different I am. Accents are hard to learn and hard to hold on to, so I will maintain it now. I am not by nature a good actor."
"May I call you Vlad?
May I call you Pietr?"
"Yes."
"Then yes, also. Lowly strategic planner cannot be more formal than hegemon of the whole world."
"You know just how much of the world I'm hegemon over," said Peter. "And, as I said, that's not why I'm here, or not directly."
"What then? You want to hire me? Not possible. They may not trust me here, but they certainly don't want me going anywhere else. I'm a hero of the Russian people."
"Vlad, if they trusted you, what do you think you'd be doing right now?" Vlad laughed.
"Leading the armies of Mother Russia, as Alai and Hatsup and Velome and so many others are already doing. So many Alexanders."
"Yes, I've heard that comparison," said Peter, "but I see it another way. I see it as being the arms race that led up to World War I. Vlad thought for a moment.
"And we battle school brats are the arms race. If one nation has it, then another must have more. Yes, that's what our shield's little venture in kidnapping was about.
My point is, having a battle school graduate, particularly one of Ender's Jish, makes war more, not less, probable."
"I don't think so," said Vlad. "Yes, Hatsup and Alai are in the thick of things, but Velome wasn't in the Jish. And the rest of the Jish, Bean and Petra, are with you, struggling for world peace, yes? Like beauty pageant contestants. Dink is in a joint Anglo-American project, which means he has had his balls cut off, militarily speaking. Shen is marking time in some ceremonial position in Tokyo. Domper is a monk, I think, or whatever they called him, a shaman, in the Andes somewhere. Crazy, Tom. Is that Sandhurst confined to a classroom? Karn Carby is in Australia, where they may or may not have a military, but nobody cares. And Fly Molo, well, he is a busy boy in the Philippines, but not their president or even an important general.
That squares with my tally, though I think Karn would argue with you about the value of the Australian military. Vlad waved the objection aside. My point is, most nations that have this treasured national resource are far more concerned to keep us under observation and away from power than to actually use us to make war.
Peter smiled. Yes, either they have you up to your elbows in blood, or they have you locked in a box. Anybody happily married?
We are none of us even 25 yet. Well, maybe Dink. He always lied about his age. Most of us are in our teens or barely out of them.
They're afraid of you. All the more so now because the nations that actually use their Jish members in war are now governed by them.
If you can call worldwide Islam a nation, I personally call it a riot with scripture.
Just don't say that in Baghdad or Tehran, said Peter.
As if I could ever go to those places.
Vlad, said Peter, how would you like to be free of all this beauty? Vlad hooted with laughter.
So you're here representing Graf?
Peter was taken aback. Graf came to you?
Be head of a colony, get away from it all expenses paid, vacation. That takes the rest of your life.
Not a vacation, said Peter. Very hard work, but at least you have a life.
So, Pietro, the hegemon wants Anders Jish off-planet forever.
Do you want my job, said Peter? I'll resign it today if I thought it would go to you, or to any member of Anders Jish. You want it? Think you could hold it? Then it's yours. I only have it because I wrote the Locke essays and stopped a war. But what have I done lately? Vlad, I don't see you as a rival. How could I? What freedom do you have to oppose me? Vlad shrugged.
All right. So, your motives are pure.
My motives are realistic, said Peter. Russia's not using you right now, but they haven't killed you or locked you up. If they ever decide that war is desirable or necessary or unavoidable, how long before you get promoted and put into the thick of things, especially if the war goes badly for a while? You are their nuclear arsenal.
Not really, said Vlad. Since my brain is supposed to be the payload of this particular missile, and my brain was defective enough to seem to trust our shield, then I must not be as good as the other Jish members.
In a war against Hansu, how long before you commanded an army, or at least were put in charge of strategy?
15 minutes, give or take.
So? Is Russia more or less likely to go to war, knowing they have you? Vlad smiled a little and ducked his head.
Well, well. So the hegemon wants me out of Russia, so Russia won't be so adventurous.
Not quite so simple, said Peter. There'll come a day when much of the world will have merged their sovereignty,
by which you mean they will have surrendered it
into one government. It won't be the big nations, just a bunch of little ones. But unlike the United Nations and the League of Nations and even the hegemony in its previous form, it will not be designed to keep the central government as powerless as possible. The nations in this league will maintain no separate army or navy or air force. They will not have separate control over their own borders, and they will collect no customs, nor will they maintain a separate merchant marine. The hegemony will have power over foreign policy, period, without rival. Why would Russia ever join such a confederacy?
It never would, Peter nodded and waited. It never would unless it thought that it was the only safe thing to do.
Add the word profitable into that sentence, and you'll be closer to right.
Russians are not Americans like you, Peter Wiggin. We don't do things for profit motive.
So all those bribes go into charitable causes?
They keep the bookmakers and the prostitutes of Russia from starving, said Vlad. Altruism at its finest.
Vlad, said Peter, all I'm saying is think about this. Ender Wiggin did two great deeds for humanity. He wiped out the buggers, and he never returned to Earth.
Vlad turned on Peter with real fire in his eyes. "Do you think I don't know who arranged for that?"
"I advocated it," said Peter. "I wasn't hegemon then. But do you dare to tell me I was wrong? What would have happened if Ender himself were here on Earth? Everybody's hostage. And if his homeland managed to keep him safe, what then? Ender Wiggin, the bugger slayer, now at the head of the armed forces of the dreaded United States? Think of the jockeying, the alliances, the preemptive attacks, all because this great and terrible weapon was in the hands of the nation that still thinks it has the right to judge and govern all the world." Vlad nodded. "So, it's just a happy coincidence that it left you without a rival for the hegemony?" "I have rivals, Vlad. The Caliph has millions of followers who believe that he's the one God chose to be ruler over the earth. Aren't you making the same offer to Eli?"
"Vlad," said Peter, "I don't expect to persuade you, only to inform you. If there comes a day when you think your best hope of safety is to leave Earth, post a note to me at the website I'll link to you in an email. Or if you realize that the only chance your nation has of peace is for all its battle school grads to disappear from Earth, tell me, and I'll do all I can to get them safely out and off.
Unless I go to my superiors and tell them all that you just told me."
"Tell them," said Peter. "Tell them and lose the last shreds of freedom that you have."
"So I won't tell them," said Vlad.
"And you'll think about it. It will be there in the back of your mind."
"And when all the battle school grads are gone," said Vlad, "there will be Peter, brother of Ender Wiggin, the natural ruler of all humankind."
"Yes, Vlad, the only chance we have of unity is to have a strong consensus leader, our George Washington.
And that's you."
"It could be a caliph, and we'd have a future as a Muslim world. Or we might all be made into vassals of the Middle Kingdom. Or, tell me, Vlad, should we prefer to be ruled over by the government that now treats you so kindly?"
"I'll think about this," said Vlad. "And you, think about something else. Ambition was part of the basis by which we were chosen for battle school. Just how self-sacrificing do you think we'll be? Look at Verlomi. As shy a person as battle school could possibly admit, but to achieve her purpose she made herself into a god. And she does seem to play the part with enthusiasm, doesn't she?"
"Ambition balanced against survival instinct," said Peter. "Ambition leads you to greater risk, but ambition never leads you to certain destruction.
Unless you're a fool."
"There are no fools in this park today," said Peter. "Unless you count the spies lying underwater, breathing through straws in order to overhear our conversation."
"It's the best the Estonians can do," said Vlad.
"I'm glad to know that Russians haven't forgotten their sense of humor. Everybody knows a few dozen Estonian jokes."
"Who do Estonians tell jokes about?" asked Peter.
"Estonians, of course. Only they don't realize that they're jokes."
Laughing, they left the park and headed back, Peter to his chauffeured car, Vlad to the train back to St. Petersburg.
Some battle school graduates came to Hibero Preto to hear Peter's invitation. Others Peter contacted through mutual friends. Members of Ender's Jeesh Peter met with directly. Karn Karby in Australia, Dink Meeker and Crazy Tom in England, Shen in Tokyo, Fly Molo in Manila, and Dumper amid a council of Chechuas in the ruins of Machu Picchu, his unofficial headquarters as he worked steadily to organize the Native Americans of South America. None of them accepted his offer. All of them listened and remembered. Meanwhile, the guerrilla fighting in India grew more savage. More and more Persian and Pakistani troops were withdrawn from China, until the day came when there was no one penning in the starving Chinese army in Sichuan province. Hanzu set it in motion. The Turks withdrew to Xinjiang province. The Indonesians got back in their boats and withdrew to Taiwan. the Arabs joined in the occupation of India. Han China was free of foreign occupiers, without the emperor firing a shot. At once, the Americans and Europeans and Latin Americans were back, buying and selling, helping China recover from empty wars of conquest, while the Muslim nations continued to bleed weapons and wealth and men in the ever more brutal war to control India. Meanwhile, a new pair of essayists emerged on the nets. One styled himself Lincoln and spoke of the need to put an end to bloody wars and oppression, and to secure the rights and freedoms of all societies by giving an honest, law-abiding world government exclusive control of all weapons of war. The other called himself Martel, harking back to Charles the Hammer, who stopped the Muslim advance into Europe at Poitiers. Martel kept pounding at the grave danger the world faced from the existence of a caliph. The Muslims, who now made up more than a third of the population of some European countries, would be emboldened, seize power, and force all of Europe to live under brutal Muslim law. There were some commentators who saw in these two new essayists a similarity to the days when Locke and Demosthenes dueled, with a similar division between statesmanlike peace-seeking and warnings of war. Those had turned out to be written by Peter and Valentine Wigan. Only once did Peter answer a question about Lincoln. "There are several ways the world could be united. I'm glad that I'm not the only one who hopes it will be through a liberal democracy rather than a conquering despotism." And only once did Peter comment when questioned about Martel. "I don't believe it helps the cause of peace in the world to stir up the kind of fear and hatred that leads to expulsions and genocide." Both answers only added to the credibility of the two essayists.
Chapter 8. Ender. From Raket, Armenian at hegemon.gov, to Nagin, Lima at hegemon.gov. Ray, I'm having fun, so don't carp. Beloved husband, what else can I do while I'm sitting around with a belly the size of a barn except type? It's actually hard work, considering the keyboard is at arm's length, and it's not as if anti-Muslim propaganda is harder than breathing. I'm Armenian, O father of the balloon I'm carrying around inside my abdomen. We learn about how Muslims, Turks in particular, of course, have been slaughtering Armenian Christians from time immemorial. How they can never be trusted. And guess what? When I look for evidence, ancient and contemporary, I don't have to get out of my chair. So I will continue to write the Martel essays and continue to laugh while they accuse Peter of writing them. Of course, I am doing it at his request, which is what I understand Valentine did for him when she wrote Demosthenes' essays back when we were all in school. But you know that nobody will listen to his Lincoln stuff unless they're also terrified. Either terrified of Muslims taking over the world, id est, more particularly their neighborhood, or terrified of the hideous bloodshed that would ensue if nations with Muslim minorities actually started restricting them or expelling them. Besides, Bean, I think that what I'm saying is true. Ali means well, but he clearly is not in control of his fanatical supporters. They really are murdering people and calling it executions. They really are trying to rule over India. They really are agitating and rioting and committing the odd atrocity in Europe right now, pushing to have European nations declare for the caliph and cease trading with China, which really is supplying Verlomi. And now this essay will end because the stomach aches I've been having are clearly not stomach aches. This baby thinks it's coming, 2 months prematurely. Please get back here right away.
Peter waited outside the delivery room with Anton and Ferreira. "Does this premature birth mean anything?" he asked Anton. "They wouldn't let the doctors amnio the baby," said Anton, "so I didn't have any reliable genetic material to work with. But we know that in the early stages, maturity is highly accelerated. It seems possible to me that premature birth is consistent with the key being turned. My thought, said Peter, is that this might be the break we need to find the other babies and unravel Valescu's network. Because the others might be premature too, asked Ferreira. I think Valescu had a dead man's switch, and sometime after he was arrested, a warning went out, and all the surrogate mothers bolted. That wouldn't help us before, because we didn't know when the signal went out, and pregnant women may be one of the more stable demographic groups, but they do move around by the hundreds of thousands. Ferreira nodded, but now we can try to correlate premature births with abrupt moves at the same time as other women with similarly premature births, and then check funding. They'll have the best possible hospital care, and somebody's paying for it. Unless, said Anton, this baby is premature because Petra herself has some kind of problem. There's no history of premature births in her family, said Peter, and the baby has been developing quickly, not in size, mind you, but the parts were all in place before schedule, so I think this baby is like Bean. I think the key is turned. So let's use it as a key to finding where Valescu went and where those viruses might be waiting to be released. Not to mention finding Beans and Petra's babies, said Anton. Of course, said Peter. That's the main purpose. He turned to the managing nurse. Have someone call me when we know anything about the condition of the mother and baby.
Bean sat down beside Petra's bed. How do you feel? Not as bad as I expected, she said. That's one good thing about premature delivery, he said. Smaller baby, easier birth. He's doing fine. They're only keeping him in neonate intensive care because of his size. All his other organs are working. He's like you. Anton is supervising the analysis right now, but that's my guess. He held her hand. The thing we wanted to avoid. If he's like you, she said, then I'm not sorry. If he's like me, said Bean, then it means Valescu really didn't have any kind of test. Or he had one, and discarded the babies that were normal. Or maybe they're all like me. The thing you wanted to avoid, she whispered. Our little miracles, said Bean. I hope you're not too disappointed. I hope you think of it as a chance to see what your life might have been like if you had grown up with parents, in a home, not barely escaping with your life and then scrabbling to survive on the streets of Rotterdam, at the age of one. Think what it would be like to raise this baby surrounded by love, teaching him as fast as he wants to learn. All those lost years, recovered for our baby. Bean shook his head. I hoped the baby would be normal, he said. I hoped they'd all be normal, so I wouldn't have to consider this. Consider what? Taking the baby with me. With you where? Asked Petra. The IF has a new starship. Very secret. A messenger ship. It uses a gravity field to offset acceleration. Up to light speed in a week. The plan is that once we find the babies, I take the ones like me, and we take off and keep traveling until they find the cure for this. Once you're gone, said Petra, why do you think the fleet will bother even looking for a cure? Because they want to know how to turn Anton's key without the side effects, said Bean. They'll keep working on it. Petra nodded. She was taking this better than Bean expected. All right, she said. As soon as we find the babies, then we go. We, said Bean. I'm sure in your normal, legumocentric view of the universe, it didn't cross your mind that there's no reason I shouldn't go along with you. Petra, it means being cut off from the human race. It's different for me because I'm not human. That again. What kind of life is that for the normal babies? Growing up confined to a starship? It would only seem like weeks, Bean. How grown up will they be? You'd be cut off from everything. Your family, everybody. You stupid man, she said. You are everybody now. You and our babies. You could raise the normal babies normally, with grandparents, a normal life, a fatherless life, and their siblings off on a starship so they'll never even meet? I don't think so, Bean. Do you think I'm going to give birth to this little boy and then let somebody take him away from me? Bean stroked her cheek, her hair. Petra, there's a whole bunch of rational arguments against what you're saying, but you just gave birth to my son, and I'm not going to argue with you now. You're right, said Petra. By all means, let's avoid this discussion until I've nursed the baby for the first time, and it becomes even more impossible for me to consider letting you take him away from me. But I'll tell you this right now. I will never change my mind. And if you maneuver things so you sneak off and steal my son from me and leave me a widow without even my child to raise, then you're worse than Valescu. When he stole our children, we knew he was an amoral monster. But you're my husband. If you do that to me, I'll pray that God puts you in the deepest part of hell. Petra, you know I don't believe in hell. But knowing that I'm praying such a thing, that will be hell for you. Petra, I won't do anything you don't agree to. Then I'm coming with you, she said, because I'll never agree to anything else. So it's decided. There's no discussion to have later when I'm rational. I'm already as rational as I'll ever be. In fact, there's no rational reason why I shouldn't come along if I want to. It's an excellent idea. And being raised on a starship has to be better than being orphaned on the streets of Rotterdam. No wonder they named you after Rock, said Bean. I don't give up, and I don't wear down. I'm not just Rock. I'm Diamond. Her eyelids were heavy. Go to sleep now, Petra. Only if I can hold on to you, she said. He took her hand. She gripped it fiercely. I got you to give me a baby, she said. Don't think for a minute I am not going to get my way in this, too. I promised you already, Petra, said Bean. Whatever we do, it'll be because you agree it's the right thing. Think you want to leave me? Voyage to nowhere? Think nowhere's better than living with me? That's right, baby, said Bean, stroking her arm with his other hand. Nowhere is better than living with you.
They had the baby christened by a priest. He came into neonate intensive care. Not the first time he'd done it, of course, baptizing distressed newborns before they died. He seemed relieved to learn that this baby was strong and healthy and likely to survive, despite how tiny he was. Andrew Arcanian Delphiki, I baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. It was quite a crowd gathered around the neonate incubator to watch. Bean's family, Petra's family, and, of course, Anton and Ferreira and Peter and the Wigan parents and Suriyawang and those members of Bean's little army who weren't actually on assignment. They had to wheel the incubator cart out into a waiting room to have space enough to hold everybody. You're going to call him Ender, aren't you? Said Peter. Until he makes a stop, said Petra. What a relief, said Teresa Wigan. Now you won't have to name a child of your own after your brother, Peter. Peter ignored her, which meant that her words had really stung. The baby is named for Saint Andrew, said Petra's mother. Babies are named for saints, not soldiers. Of course, mother, said Petra. Ender and our baby were both named for Saint Andrew. Anton and his team learned that, yes, the baby definitely had Bean's syndrome. The key was turned. And having two sets of genes to compare confirmed that Bean's genetic modification bred true.
But there's no reason to suppose that all the babies will have the modification, he reported to Bean, Petra, and Peter. The likelihood is that the trait is dominant, however, so any child who has it should be on the fast track.
Premature birth, said Bean.
And we can guess that statistically, half the 8 babies should have the trait, Mendel's law. Not ironclad, because randomness is involved. So there might be only 3, or 5, or more, or this might be the only one. But the likeliest thing...
We know how the probability works, Professor, said Ferreira.
I wanted to emphasize the uncertainty.
Believe me, said Ferreira, uncertainty is my life. Right now, we found either 24 or nearly 100 groups of women who gave birth within 2 weeks of Petra, and who moved at the same time as others in their group since the day Valescu was arrested.
How can you not even know how many groups you have? Asked Bean.
Selection criteria, said Petra.
If we divide them into groups that left within 6 hours of each other, then we get the higher total. If we divide them into groups that left within 2 days of each other, the lower total. Plus, we can shift the time frames, and the groups also shift.
What about prematurity in the babies?
That supposes that the doctors are aware that the babies are premature, said Ferreira. Low birth weight is what we went for. We eliminated any babies that were higher than the low end of normal. Most of them will be premature, but not all.
And all of this, said Petra, depends on all the babies being on the same clock.
It's all we can go on, said Peter. If it turns out that Anton's key doesn't make them all triggered delivery after about the same gestation time, well, it's no more of a problem than the fact that we don't know when the other embryos were implanted.
Some of the embryos might have been implanted much more recently, said Ferreira.
So we're going to keep adding women to the database as they give birth to low birth weight children and turn out to have moved at about the time Valescu was arrested. You realize how many variables there are that we don't know? How many of the embryos have Anton's key? When they were implanted? If they were all implanted? If Valescu even had a dead man switch?
I thought you said he did.
He did, said Ferreira. We just don't know what the switch was about. Maybe it was for release of the virus. Maybe for the mothers to move. Maybe both. Maybe neither.
A lot of things we don't know, said Bean.
Remarkable how little we got from Valescu's computer.
He's a careful man, said Ferreira. He knew perfectly well that he'd be caught someday, and his computer seized. We learned more than he could have imagined, but less than we had hoped.
Just keep looking, said Petra.
Meanwhile, I have a baby-shaped suction cup to go attach to one of the tenderest parts of my body. Promise me that he won't develop teeth early.
I don't know, said Bean. I can't remember not having them.
Thanks for the encouragement, said Petra.
Bean got up in the night, as usual, to get little Ender so Petra could nurse him. Tiny as he was, he had a pair of lungs on him. Nothing small about his voice. And, as usual, once the baby started suckling, Bean watched until Petra rolled over to feed the baby on the other side. Then he slept. Until he awoke again. Usually he didn't, so for all he knew it was like this every time. Because Petra was still nursing the baby, but she was also crying. Baby, what's wrong? Said Bean, touching her shoulder. Nothing, she said. She wasn't crying anymore. Don't try to lie to me, said Bean. You were crying. I'm so happy, she said. You were thinking about how old little Ender will be when he dies. That's silly, she said. We're going off in a starship until they find a cure. He's going to live to be 100. Petra, said Bean. What? I'm not lying. You're crying because in your mind's eye you can already see the death of your baby. She sat up and lifted the now sleeping baby to her shoulder. Bean, you really are bad at guessing things like this. I was crying because I thought of you as a little baby, and how you didn't have a father to go and get you when you cried in the night. and you didn't have a mother to hold you and feed you from her own body, and you had no experience of love. But when I finally found out what it was, I got more of it than any man could hope for. Damn right, said Petra. And don't you forget it. She got up and took the baby back to the bassinet. And tears came to Bean's eyes. Not pity for himself as a baby, but remembering Sister Carlotta, who had become his mother and stayed with him long before he learned what love was and was able to give any back to her. And some of his tears were also for Poke, the friend who took him in when he was in the last stages of death by malnutrition in Rotterdam. Petra, don't you know how short life is, even when you don't have some disease like Anton's key? So many people prematurely in their graves, and some of them I put there. Don't cry for me. Cry for my brothers who were disposed of by Valescu as he destroyed evidence of his crimes. Cry for all the children that no one ever loved. Bean thought he was being subtle, turning his head so Petra couldn't see his tears when she came back to bed. Whether she saw or not, she snuggled close to him and held him. How could he tell this woman, who had always been so good to him and loved him more than he knew how to return? How could he tell her that he had lied to her? He didn't believe that there would ever be a cure for Anton's key. When he got on that starship with the babies that had his same disease, he expected to take off and head outward into the stars. He would live long enough to teach the children how to run the starship. They would explore. They would send reports back by Ansible. They would map habitable planets farther away than any other humans would want to travel. In 15 or 20 years of subjective time, they would live 1,000 years or more in real time, and the data they collected would be a treasure trove. They would be the pioneers of 100 colonies or more. And then they would die, having no memory of setting foot on a planet, and having no children to carry on their disease for another generation. And it would all be bearable, for them and for Bean, because they would know that back on Earth, their mother and their healthy siblings were living normal lives and marrying and having children of their own, so that by the time their 1,000-year voyage was over, every living human being would be related to them one way or another. That's how we'll be part of everything. So no matter what I promised, Petra, you're not coming with me. And neither are our healthy children. And someday you'll understand and forgive me for breaking my word to you.
Chapter 9. Pension. From Peter Wiggin, personal at hegemon.gov, to Champi. Titu at quechuanation.freenet.ne.com. The best hope of the Quechua and Aymara peoples. Dear Champi Titu, thank you for consenting to visit with me. Considering that I tried to call you Dumper as if you were still a child in battle school and a friend of my brother, I'm surprised you didn't toss me out on the spot. As I promised, I am sending you the current draft of the Constitution of the Free People of Earth. You are the first person outside the innermost circle of hegemony officials to look at it, and please remember that it is only a draft. I would be grateful for your suggestions. My goal is to have a constitution that would be as attractive to nations that are recognized as states as to peoples that are still stateless. The constitution will fail if the language is not identical for both. Therefore, there are aspirations you would have to give up and claims you would have to relinquish. But I think you will see that the same will be true for the states that now occupy territory you claim for the Quechua and Aymara peoples. The principles of majority, viability, contiguity, and compactness would guarantee you a self-governing territory, albeit one much smaller than your present claim. but your present claim, while historically justifiable, is also unattainable without a bloody war. Your military abilities are sufficient to guarantee that the contest would be far more evenly matched than the governments of Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and Colombia would anticipate. But even if you won a complete victory, who would be your successor? I speak candidly because I believe that you are not following a delusion but embarking on a specific attainable enterprise. The root of war might succeed for a time, and the operative word is might, since nothing is certain in war, but the cost in blood, economic losses, and ill will for generations to come will be steep. Ratifying the hegemony constitution, on the other hand, will guarantee you a homeland, to which those who insist on being governed only by Quechua and Aymara leaders and raising their children to be Quechua and Aymara speakers may migrate freely without needing anyone's permission. But take note of the irrevocability clause. I can promise you that this will be taken very seriously. Do not ratify this constitution if you and your people do not intend to abide by it. As for the personal question you asked me, I don't believe it matters whether I'm the one who unites the world under one government. No individual is irreplaceable. However, I am quite certain that it will need to be a person exactly like me. And at present, the only person who meets that requirement is me. Committed to a liberal government with the highest degree of personal freedom. Equally committed to tolerating no breach of the peace or oppression of one people by another, and strong enough to make it happen and make it stick. Join with me, Champi Titu, and you will not be an insurrectionary hiding out in the Andes. You will be a head of a state within the hegemony constitution. And if you are patient and wait until I have won the ratification of at least two of the nations at issue, then you and all the world can see how peacefully and equitably the rights of native peoples can be handled. It only works if every party is determined to make the sacrifices necessary to ensure the peace and freedom of all other parties. If even one party is determined on a course of war or oppression, then someday that party will find itself bearing the full weight of the pressure the free nations can bring to bear. Right now, that isn't much. But how long do you think it will take me to make it a considerable force indeed? If you are with me, Champi Titu, you will need no other ally. Sincerely, Peter.
Something was bothering Bean, nagging at the back of his mind. He thought at first that it was a feeling caused by his fatigue, getting so little uninterrupted sleep at night. Then he chalked it up to anxiety because his friends, well, Ender's and Petra's friends, were involved in a life-or-death struggle in India, which they couldn't possibly all win. And then, in the middle of changing Ender's diaper, it came to him. Perhaps because of his baby's name. Perhaps, he thought bitterly, because of what he had his hands in. He finished diapering the baby and left him in the bassinet where Petra, dozing, would hear him if he cried. Then he went in search of Peter. Naturally, it wasn't easy to get in to see him. Not that there was so huge a bureaucracy in Ribeirão Preto, but it was large enough now that Peter could afford to pay for a few layers of protection. Nobody who just stood there being a guard, but a secretary here, a clerk there, and Bean found he had explained himself three times at 5:30 in the morning before he even got to see Teresa Wigan. And now that he thought about it, he wanted to see her. He's on the phone with some European bigwig, she told him. Either sucking up or getting sucked up too, depending on how big and powerful the country is. So that's why everybody's up early. He tries to get up early enough to catch a significant part of the working day in Europe, which is hard because it's usually only a few hours in the morning. Their morning. So I'll talk to you. Well, that's a puzzler, said Teresa. Business so important that you get up at 5:30 to see Peter, and yet so unimportant that when you find out he's on a phone call, you can actually talk to me about it. She said it with such verve that Bean might have missed the bitter complaint behind her words. "So he still treats you like a ceremonial mother?" asked Bean. "Does the butterfly consult with the cocoon?" "So, how do your other children treat you?" asked Bean. Her face darkened. "This is your business?" He wasn't sure if the question was pointed irony, as in, "That's none of your business," or a simple question. "This is what you came for?" He took it the first way. "Ender's my friend," said Bean. "More than anybody else except Petra. I miss him. I know there's an Ansible on his ship. I just wondered." "I'm 46 years old," said Teresa. "When Val and Andrew get to their destination, I'll be old. Why should they write to me?" "So they haven't." "If they have, the IF hasn't seen fit to inform me." "They're bad at mail delivery, as I recall. They seem to think that the best family therapy method is out of sight, out of mind. Or Andrew and Valentine can't be bothered." Teresa typed something. "There. Another letter I'll never send." "Who are you writing to?" "Whom? You foreigners are wrecking the English language." "I'm not speaking English. I'm speaking common. There's no whom in common." "I'm writing to Verlomi and telling her to wise up to the fact that Suriyawong is still in love with her, and she has no business trying to play God in India when she could do it for real by marrying and having babies." "She doesn't love Suri," said Bean. "Someone else, then?" "India. It's way past patriotism with her." "Matriotism. Nobody thinks of India as the fatherland." "And you're the matriarch, dispensing maternal advice to battle school grads. Just the ones from Ender's Jeesh who happen now to be heads of state, or insurrectionary leaders, or in this case, fledgling deities." "Just one question for you," said Bean. "Ah, back to the subject. Is Ender getting a pension?" "Pension?" "Yes, I think so." "Yes, of course. And what is his pension doing while he's puttering along at light speed?" "Gathering interest, I imagine." "So you're not administering it?" "Me? I don't think so." "Your husband?" "I'm the one who handles the money," said Teresa. "Such as it is. We don't get a pension. Come to think of it, we don't get a salary either. We're just hangers-on. Camp followers. We're both on leave of absence at the university because it was too dangerous for potential hostages to be out where enemies could kidnap us. Of course, the main kidnapper is dead, but here we stay." "So the IF is holding on to Ender's money." "What are you getting at?" asked Teresa. "I don't know," said Bean. "I was wiping my little Ender's butt and I thought, there's an awful lot of shit here." "They drink and drink. The breast doesn't seem to get smaller. And they poop more than they could possibly get from the breast without shriveling it into a raisin. And then I thought, I know how much I'm getting in my pension. And it's kind of a lot. I don't actually have to work at anything as long as I live. Petra, too. Most of it we simply invest. Roll it back into investments. It's adding up fast. Pretty soon our income from invested pension is going to be greater than the original pension we invested. Of course, that's partly because we have so much inside information. You know, about which wars are about to start and which will fizzle, that sort of thing." "You're saying that somebody ought to be watching over Andrew's money." "I'll tell you what," said Bean. "I'll find out from Graf who's taking care of it." "You want to invest it?" asked Teresa. "Going into brokering or financial management when Peter has finally achieved world peace?" "I won't be here when Peter..." Oh, Bean, for heaven's sake, don't take me seriously and make me feel bad for acting as if you weren't going to die. I prefer not to think of you dying.
I was only saying that I'm not a good person to manage Ender's portfolio.
So, who?
Wouldn't that be whom?
She grimaced.
No, it would not. Not even if you spoke English. I don't know. I've got no candidate.
And so you wanted to confer with Peter?
Bean shrugged.
But that would make no sense at all. Peter doesn't know anything about investing and...
No, no, no. I see what you're getting at.
How? When I'm not sure myself.
Oh, you're sure?
You think Peter is financing some of this from Andrew's pension. You think he's embezzling from his brother.
I doubt Peter would call it embezzling.
What would he call it then?
In Peter's mind, Ender's probably buying government bonds issued by the hegemony. So when the hegemon rules the world, Ender will get 4% per year tax-free. Even I know that would be a lousy investment. From a financial point of view. Mrs. Wiggin, Peter has the use of more money than the scant dues the few dues-paying nations still pay to the hegemony.
The dues go up and down, said Teresa.
He tells you?
John Paul is closer to these things.
When the world is worried about war, money flows into the hegemony. Not a lot, just a little extra. When I first got here, there were Peter, you two, and the soldiers I brought with me. A couple of secretaries. And a lot of debt. Yet Peter always had enough money to send us out in the choppers we brought with us. Money for fuel, money for ammunition.
Bean, what will be gained if you accuse Peter of embezzling Ender's pension?
You know Peter isn't making himself rich with it.
No,
but he is making himself hegemon. Ender might need that money someday.
Ender will never come back to Earth, Bean.
How valuable will money be on the new world he's going to colonize? What harm is it causing? So you're all right with Peter cheating his brother?
If he's doing that.
Which I doubt. Teresa's smile was tight and her eyes flashed just a little. Mother bear, guarding cub. Protect the son who's here even if he's cheating the son who's gone.
Why don't you go back to your place and take care of your own child instead of meddling with mine?
And the pioneers circle the wagons to protect from the arrows of the Native Americans.
I like you, Bean. I'm also worried about you. I'll miss you when you die.
I'll do my best to help Petra get through the hard times ahead. But keep your hippo-sized hands off my son. He has the weight of the world on his shoulders, in case you didn't notice.
I think maybe I won't have that interview with Peter this morning after all.
Delighted to be of service, said Teresa. Do avoid telling him I stopped by, will you?
With pleasure.
In fact, I've already forgotten that you're here. She turned back to the computer and typed again. Bean rather hoped she was typing meaningless words and strings of letters because she was too angry to be writing anything intelligible. He even thought of peeking just to see. But Teresa was a good friend who happened to be protective of her son. No reason to turn her into an enemy. He sauntered away, his long legs carrying him much farther, much faster than a man walking so slowly should have gone. And even though he wasn't moving quickly, he still felt his heart pump faster. Just to walk down a corridor, it's as if he were jogging a little.
How much time?
Not as much as I had yesterday.
Teresa watched him go and thought, I love that boy for being so loyal to Ender. And he's absolutely right to suspect Peter. It's just the sort of thing he'd do. For all I know, Peter got us back onto full salary at the university, too, only he didn't tell us and he's cashing our checks. Then again, Maybe he's secretly getting paid by China, or America, or some other country that values his services as hegemon. Unless they value his services as Lincoln, or as Martel, if he was really writing the Martel essays. Such a thing smacked of Peter's propaganda methods, but the writing sounded nothing like him, and it could hardly be Valentine this time. Had he found another surrogate writer? Maybe somebody was contributing in a big way to Martel's cause, and Peter was pocketing the money to advance his own. But no. Word of such contributions would get out. Peter would never be so foolish as to accept money that might compromise him if he were found out. I'll check with Graf, see whether the IF is paying out the pension to Peter. And if it is, I'll have to kill the boy. Or at least make my disappointed-in-you face, and then curse about him to John Paul when we're alone.
Bean told Petra he was going to train with Suri and the boys. And he did. Go where they were training, that is. But he spent his time in one of the choppers, making a scrambled and encrypted call to the old battle school space station, where Graf was assembling his fleet of colony ships. "Going to come visit me?" said Graf. "Want to take a trip into space?" "Not yet," said Bean. "Not till I've found my lost kids." "So you have other business to discuss?" "Yes." "But you'll immediately realize that the business I want to talk about is none of my business." "Can't wait." "Nope, got to wait. Call I can't turn down. Wait just a minute, please." The hiss of atmosphere and magnetic fields and radiation between the surface of the Earth and the space station. Bean thought of breaking off the connection and waiting for another time. Or maybe dropping the whole stupid line of inquiry. Just as Bean was going to terminate the call, Graf came back on. "Sorry. I'm in the middle of tricky negotiations with China to let breeding couples emigrate. They want to send us some of their surplus males. I told him we were forming a colony, not fighting a war. But negotiating with the Chinese. You think you hear yes, but the next day you find out they said no very delicately and then tittered behind their hands. All those years controlling the size of their population, and now they won't let go of a measly few thousand," said Bean. "So you called me. What is it that's none of your business?" "I get my pension. Petra gets hers. Who gets Ender's?" "My, but you're to the point." "Is it going to Peter?" "What an excellent question." "May I make a suggestion?" "Please." "As I recall, you have a history of making interesting suggestions." "Stop sending the pension to anybody." "I'm the Minister of Colonization now," said Graf. "I take my orders from the hegemon." "You're in bed so deep with the IF that Chamrajnagar thinks you're a hemorrhoid and wakes up scratching at you." "You have a vast, untapped potential as a poet," said Graf. "My suggestion," said Bean, "is to get the IF to turn Ender's money over to a neutral party." "When it comes to money, there are no neutral parties. The IF and the colony program both spend money as fast as it comes in. We have no idea where to begin an investment program. And if you think I'm trusting some Earthside mutual fund with the entire savings of a war hero who won't even be able to inquire about the money for another 30 years, you're insane." "I was thinking that you could turn it over to a computer program." "You think we didn't think of that? The best investment programs are only 2% better at predicting markets and bringing a positive return on investment than closing your eyes and stabbing the stock listings with a pin." "You mean with all the computer expertise and all the computer facilities of the fleet, you can't devise a neutral program to handle Ender's money?"